Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+, simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
Marilyn Monroe and her life is an image for the way in which the sexual revolution is promoted as this wonderful thing, but all the problems are airbrushed out.
To a stranger who walks in, who doesn't know all the same 30 praise choruses that are currently hot on the pop charts, that can be as off-putting and intimidating as someone walking into a Greek Orthodox church and having the whole service being Greek.
So we can say, when we look at the manifestation of tongues where people lose control of themselves, that it is clearly an evidence not of the presence of the Holy Spirit, but of the absence of the Holy Spirit.
Confessional Lutheran Deadheads love Issues Etc.
Well, the AP headline making the rounds says, court ruling against gay marriage could cause legal chaos. Is that true? Of course, the court is entertaining the notion of same-sex marriage at a constitutional level, and there are, I guess, several things that the court could do about this. How much of this is expectation lowering? How much of this is true? And should, here's the real question, should a justice sitting on the Supreme Court, should he or she take into account the anticipated or the promised or the potential fallout from a decision when making a decision, especially when it comes to something as fundamental as the American definition of marriage? Greetings, welcome to Issues Etc. live this Wednesday afternoon, June the 10th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. John Eastman's going to join us here for the first few minutes, professor of law and community service at Chapman University in Orange, California. We'll talk about the Supreme Court ruling against same-sex marriage or for same-sex marriage will either cause legal chaos. A little bit later, Dr. Thomas Winger joins us, author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, the New Concordia Commentary on Ephesians. We'll begin a four-part weekly series with him on the book of Ephesians. Today, we'll talk about the audience of this book, the authorship of the book, this place where it holds this place in Paul's life and ministry. What is it? And the purpose and the various themes in the book of Ephesians. Get that series kicked off with him. And then we'll talk about Christian endurance. Pastor Larry Peters joins us. He's author of a recent blog post titled, God Won't Give You More Than You Can Bear. We'll talk about what that really means a little bit later here on Issues Etc. Now, you can join us for the next 2 hours with questions or comments. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MYIE. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address, @issuesetc. And our beloved on-demand listeners, feel free to use the Issues Etc. comment line whenever, wherever you're listening, 618-223-8382. Dr. John Eastman is professor of law and community service at Chapman University in Orange, California, chairman of the board of directors for the National Organization for Marriage, and founding director of the Claremont Institute's Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence. Dr. Eastman, welcome to Issues Etc.
Todd, thanks very much for having me. I'm delighted to be on your program.
Should the justices as individuals and the court as a whole, should it take into account the potential, the anticipated, or maybe even the promised fallout from a decision like this on same-sex marriage when they're making up their minds?
No, their job, and it's not making up their mind. They're interpreting, or they're supposed to be interpreting, what the Constitution requires. And if the Constitution requires a recognition of individual rights here, they are obligated to do that, even if a large majority of people go the other direction. On the other hand, if the Constitution doesn't settle this question, and it clearly doesn't, then they are obligated not to take the issue away from the people and let the people decide in their individual states how they're going to define marriage. And then there are some issues that are, you know, you really can't redefine an institution that is so rooted in our natures. Even the states ought not to be able to redefine the institution of marriage. But the potential fallout, as the AP article that's running out there today is talking about, is entirely of the aggressive litigation strategies on the other side, pushing an envelope that ought not to have been pushed, and creating a potential for chaos that is all of their own making.
So in other words, what's really being reported here, whether it's intended or not, is the strategy that the supporters of same-sex marriage have been using. And they've created a dilemma in that the Supreme Court will, if it decides against them, will undo a lot of their successes.
Well, that's right. And you know, part of it is because the lower courts ignored governing Supreme Court precedent from 40 years ago that had already taken up and settled this question. Does the Constitution's Equal Protection or Due Process Clause require states to redefine marriage to include same-sex relationships? The court said no to that back in 1972, and the lower courts ignored that decision in rendering their judgments that striking down state man-woman marriage laws. If the Supreme Court upholds the man-woman marriage laws from Ohio and Michigan and Kentucky and Tennessee that are pending there right now, then it's further proof that all of those lower court decisions were erroneous from the get-go. And the law of the land in those states remains that man-woman marriage is the norm, is the requirement. And so the licenses that were issued prematurely based on non-final judgments in those lower courts, they kind of jumped the gun at their peril. I compare it to, you know, a business litigation fight over the validity of a patent. And if you win in the trial court and then you start acting as if the patent's your own, even though you know the case is going to be appealed, and that judgment gets reversed, you've now taken significant steps in reliance on a judgment that was not final. Well, whose fault is that? It's yours.
Tell us more about what you just mentioned there, this 1974 Supreme Court ruling that took up this subject and not only settled it then, but would appear to provide precedent for the court now.
Well, that's right. So in 1967, the Supreme Court famously decided a case of Loving versus Virginia, which struck down the prohibitions on interracial marriage that existed in a half dozen or so states. A few years after that decision, a gay couple in Minnesota filed a suit seeking a marriage license, challenging Minnesota's man-woman marriage rule as a violation of equal protection and due process. The Minnesota Supreme Court ruled against them, saying there was no constitutional challenge, no constitutional right to a same-sex marriage. They appealed that to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was a mandatory appeal in those days. The Supreme Court had to take any case that raised a federal constitutional question like that. And then they summarily affirmed the Minnesota Supreme Court. They didn't hold oral argument. They didn't accept briefing because they said there is not even a substantial federal question presented by this case. And that summary disposition of the case is binding precedent on the lower courts. Now, there's subsequent cases from the Supreme Court that have said it remains binding precedent unless further developments in our jurisprudence suggest otherwise. And so the lower courts have relied on that language and say, well, there have been further developments. We now have heightened scrutiny for gender classifications and other things. And the lower courts have said, therefore, we're not bound by that Supreme Court precedent. But the very next line in those Supreme Court cases has said, but if there are further developments, it's for us to say so, not you, the lower courts. In the meantime, you have to be bound by that decision until we tell you you're not. And that's the language that the lower courts have ignored in trying to find a new constitutional right to same-sex marriage that invalidates state laws and state constitutional provisions that exist in 39 different states.
Two questions with respect to that. First of all, I mean, I've been paying pretty close attention for about the last decade, and this is the first I have ever heard of that. Why is that?
Well, you know, partly because it's a summary disposition. And so everybody that litigates these issues knows that at the end of the day, it's not going to limit what the U.S. Supreme Court does. And since this was ultimately going to get decided by the Supreme Court, it's not made the newspaper headlines. It has, however, been a very important part of a number of the lower court decisions. The Sixth Circuit decision that's on review at the Supreme Court right now, for example, Judge Jeffrey Sutton, who wrote the opinion, spends a good portion of the opinion talking about why that decision is binding on him. And then he goes on to say, even if it wasn't, it's not unconstitutional to have man-woman marriage laws on the books.
Was it part, to our knowledge, of the Supreme Court's recent hearing?
It was not. And I think there's very good reason for that. The Supreme Court's made clear that summary dispositions don't have hardly any weight on them when they actually have the opportunity to, after full briefing and oral argument, to consider the issue anew. The issue there was it was binding on the lower courts. And when the lower courts ignored that binding precedent. And then people who won in the lower courts acted upon those victories, knowing full well that it was contrary to binding precedent, knowing full well that those decisions were not final until the Supreme Court ultimately resolved this issue. And they went ahead and acted anyway. One, you know, whatever chaos comes from their licenses perhaps being now invalidated, like I said earlier, is a result of their own doing, not some confusion in the law.
What, given what you know about the current composition of the court, the current thinking on the court is reflected in not only public statements, but also what we heard of oral arguments. What do you realistically expect this court to do and how it's going to rule?
Yeah, my prediction is that the case is 5-4. There are four solid votes to throw our marriage institution to the winds and say, you know, the court's going to decide that same-sex marriage is a fundamental right. And how they draw the line to say, well, what about polygamy, bigamy? What about age of consent? What about age of consanguinity? How close a relation can you marry? How they draw the line between those is anybody's guess. I think there are four solid votes, though, to say the Constitution requires recognition of same-sex marriage. I think there are certainly three and very likely four solid votes to say that the Constitution does no such thing. This is either an issue left up to the states, or it's an issue so fundamental and rooted in our human nature that even if a state wants to redefine it, it can't. I'm reminded of an old apocryphal story about Abraham Lincoln. Somebody asked him, if you call a dog's tail a leg, how many legs does a dog have? And he said, four. Calling the tail a leg doesn't make it a leg. So the real key, though, is the fifth vote on either side, and that's Justice Anthony Kennedy. He's certainly been very pro-gay rights in a number of opinions in the past. He was the author of the Windsor decision 2 years ago, striking down provisions of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. But that decision relied heavily on the fact that in our system, the states define marriage policy. States define domestic relations policy, not the federal government. And if that's true, and New York wanted to experiment with a new definition of marriage, he said the federal government ought to respect that. Well, if that's true, then equally the federal government, including the federal courts, ought to be respecting state decisions that don't want to experiment with a radical new definition of marriage. So all of that language in Justice Kennedy's opinion suggests that he would uphold the right of the states to have to continue to have marriage as an institution between a man and a woman. But there's other language in other parts of his opinion that suggests he might go the other direction. So it's really up for grabs, and I don't think we'll know until that opinion comes down on the last day of the court's term later this month.
If I recall, he did ask some questions in oral arguments that indicated he was at least thinking along the lines of, you know, what's the stopping point? What's the limiting factor on definitions once you've got a new definition for marriage? Didn't he ask some questions along those lines?
He did, and Justice Alito did as well, and Justice Kennedy was paying very close attention to the answers to those questions. So if you define marriage as a fundamental right, that means that triggers heightened scrutiny under existing Supreme Court precedent. That means the government could only have restrictions on that fundamental right if it had the most compelling of interests and that the restriction was narrowly tailored to further that interest. Well, what would be the compelling governmental interest about barring first cousin marriage or even a consenting adult brother-sister marriage? Well, it would introduce an anomaly into the family institution that may destroy the family, but that's exactly the same interest that is being argued by the states for man-woman marriage as well. So if it's not good enough for the current, how would it be good enough to stop that redefinition as well? All sorts of things might flow from that. And Justice Kennedy, back 2 years ago when they were hearing oral argument on this issue in the California Proposition 8 case and they couldn't reach those substantive constitutional claims because they ruled that the case was not there properly on jurisdiction, that the people that brought it there had no standing to bring it since they weren't state officials. And Justice Kennedy actually asked Ted Olson during the oral argument in that case. Ted Olson said, there's not going to be any effect to the institution of marriage. It's not going to hurt anybody. And Justice Kennedy slammed the table and said, how do you know that? You're asking us to go over a cliff, and we have no idea how far down the bottom of that abyss is. Now, if that's what kind of controls his thinking here, that you're tinkering with a core social institution that has provided unbelievably important benefits to civil society throughout all of human history, and you're going to redefine it away from its core purpose and not expect that there might be some consequences, and we're going to have the courts impose this rather than the people through deliberation kind of think about and reflect on what those consequences might be. That's a very troubling thought, and Justice Kennedy's, hand-pounding response to Ted Olson 2 years ago, I hope, remains with him foremost in his mind, to say we're not going to redefine this and engage on this really radical experiment with such an important core social institution.
If Anthony Kennedy decides to roll the dice and become the fifth vote that would give us same-sex marriage nationally, what happens next?
Well, there are two or three routes ahead of us. One is affect the next presidential election, and when there are some retirements, Justice Kennedy, Justice Ginsburg are both very close to retirement. You have them replaced by people who have more faithfully adhere to the Constitution and revisit the issue. So that's one. That's a 10-year long strategy. The second is a constitutional amendment, either coming out of Congress or arising from the states via the Constitutional Convention route, to restore some sense to our judiciary by saying the Constitution does not do what you claimed in that last opinion you said it did, and so correct it by constitutional amendment, overturn the decision by constitutional amendment, just like our 13th Amendment overturned the radically bad decision of the Supreme Court in the Dred Scott case authorizing slavery throughout the country. So you could do that. And then the third is civil disobedience. Say this is an illegitimate decision. It's binding on the parties to the case, but we're not going to treat it as binding anywhere else. And we're going to make you bring every one of these cases. The notion that whatever the judges say is all of a sudden the Constitution is not what our founders envisioned. The Constitution controls, not what the judges say about it, particularly when they're wrong. And so reviving the notion that we do not live in a regime of judicial supremacy, but we live in a regime where there are three co-equal branches of government and two levels of government, the federal government and the state governments, and having some people just react to the decision and say, we're not going to comply with that erroneous decision, your made-up interpretation of the Constitution, to force such a radical and damaging change on our civil society. So those are the three options, and I assume we have political leaders who will choose one or the other of those options, and we'll see how to fight back against what would be a devastating decision.
And then with about a minute here, if Anthony Kennedy does what it sounds like he has at least contemplated doing in the past and sides with the that slim majority against same-sex marriage, what happens after that?
Well, what happens after that would be, I think, a new effort by the pro-same-sex marriage forces to challenge the marriage laws in all of the existing states that have them, that would be either by state court judgments interpreting their state constitutions or by ballot initiatives or legislative rewriting of their marriage laws. And so there will be both new legal challenges at the state level, but also political challenges. I think there will also be an illegitimate effort in some states, like California and Oregon, for example, even though those currently binding judgments by the lower courts striking down those marriage laws would have effectively been overruled by the Supreme Court, to revisit the question requires a request from the Attorney General of those states. And since they were already colluding with the plaintiffs, they may well not bring those. And that would be an unbelievably lawless thing to do, but I expect we see that as well. So we'll have to fight back against those efforts to basically negate the ruling of the Supreme Court by those folks.
Dr. John Eastman is professor of law and community service at Chapman University in Orange, California. He's chairman of the board of directors for the National Organization for Marriage, and he's founding director of the Claremont Institute Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence. You'll find a link to the National Organization for Marriage at our website. issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Eastman, thanks for being our guest.
Todd, thank you for having me.
When we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time with a good friend of ours, Dr. Thomas Winger. He's also author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June, the New Concordia Commentary on Ephesians. Now, Ephesians is probably second to Romans, standing alongside Galatians, at the very center of the Pauline solar system. We'll find out why it occupies that place and why some might think that Ephesians is out of fashion right after this. Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu.
Hey, St. Louis. How would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952. Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. 618-670-6952.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
I just find it fascinating that so many of the issues that are out there right now are based on this false notion that men and women are completely interchangeable.
Molly Ziegler-Hemingway talking about her presentation at this summer's Issues, Etc., Making the Case Conference.
I mean, all these really hot-button issues are based on some confusion about where men and women are equal, in what terms are they equal, and then, you know, most importantly, how are we different, and is that difference a bad thing? Is it a good thing? You know, what does God have to say about these differences, and, you know, how should the Christian think about these differences? So I am so excited to come to this conference and talk about these issues, which animate so much of our political and social and cultural discourse, and also the things we struggle with in the church as well.
You can meet and hear Molly Ziegler-Hemingway making the case for the differences between men and women June 19th and 20th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.